Chapter 5. Ludwig Breyer, Albert Troska, and I are on our way to school. Lessons are to begin again. We were students at the teachers' college when the war came, but no special examination was granted to us. The men of the grammar school who went fared much better. Most of them were able to take a special examination, either before they enlisted or when they came home on leave. The remainder, who did neither the one nor the other, have now to start their schooling again like the rest of us. Karl Brugger is one of these. We pass by the cathedral. The green sheets of copper that once covered the spire have been taken away and replaced by strips of gray felt. They look mildewed and shabby, so that the church has almost the air of a factory. The sheets of copper were melted down to make shells. "The Lord God never dreamed of that, I'll bet," says Albert. In a winding alley to the west of the cathedral stands the two-storied teachers' college. Almost opposite is the grammar school. Behind it, the river and the embankment with the lime trees. Before we enlisted, these buildings made up our world. After that, it was the trenches. Now we are here again, but this is no longer our world. The trenches ousted it. In front of the grammar school, we meet our old chum, Georg Rahe. He was a lieutenant and had charge of a company, but on leave he only got drunk and loafed about and took no thought for his finals. So now he is going back into upper second again. Here already he has been twice left behind. "Is it true, Georg," I ask him, "that you've become such a crack Latin scholar up the line?" He laughs and stalks off on his long legs to the grammar school. "Watch out, you don't get a bad conduct, Mark," I shout after him. He was an airman for the last 6 months and brought down 4 Englishmen. But I don't believe he can still demonstrate Pythagoras's theorem. We go on to the teachers' college. The whole lane is teeming with uniforms. Faces suddenly loom up that one has almost forgotten, names one has not heard of for years. Hans Waldorf hobbles along. We carried him out with a shattered knee in November 17. His leg has been amputated at the hip. Now he wears a heavy, jointed wooden leg and thumps along on it noisily. Kurt Leipold appears and introduces himself laughingly. "Godfrey of the Iron Hand, gentlemen." He has an artificial right arm. Then someone comes out at the gate and says in a gurgling voice, "You don't recognize me, perhaps, eh?" I study the face, if such it can still be called. Across the forehead is a broad, red scar that runs down into the left eye. There the flesh has grown over so that the eye lies buried, deep and small. But it is there still. The right eye is fixed. That is glass. The nose is clean gone. A black patch covers the place. The scar continues below it and splits the mouth in two. The mouth itself is bulbous. The parts have grown together askew, hence the unintelligible speech. The teeth are artificial. A bracket is visible across them. In doubt still, I continue to look at him. "Paul Rademacher," says the gurgling voice. I recognize him now. Why, yes, of course, the gray suit with the stripes. "Well, Paul, and what have you been doing to yourself?" "Can't you see?" he says, trying to straighten his lips. 2 cuts with a trenching tool, and these went with the rest." He shows a hand from which 3 fingers are missing. His one eye is blinking distressfully. The other looks straight ahead, fixed and unconcerned. "Wish I knew if I could still be a schoolteacher. My speech is pretty bad, isn't it? Can you understand me?"
"Sure," I answer. "And it will improve, too, as time goes on."
Besides, they'll be able to operate on it again later, of course. He shrugs his shoulders and says nothing. He does not seem very hopeful. If it were possible at all, they would have done so already, no doubt. Vili barges his way through to us to give us the latest news. Borkman, we hear, died of his lung wound after all. He developed galloping consumption. Hence it, too. He shot himself when he found out his spine injury could only end in an invalid's chair for life. No wonder. He used to be our best footballer. Meyer was killed in September.
Lichtenfeld in June. Lichtenfeld was out there only 2 days.
We stop suddenly. A diminutive little figure is standing before us.
No, not Westerholt, says Vili incredulously.
The very same, you old mushroom, he answers.
Vili is staggered.
But you're dead.
Not yet, retorts Westerholt amicably.
But I saw it in the newspaper.
That was just a misprint, says Westerholt with a wide grin.
A man can't rely on anything these days, says Vili, shaking his head. I thought the worms had eaten you long ago.
After you, Vili, answers Westerholt complacently. You'll be the first. Red-haired people never live long.
We go in. The quadrangle where we used to eat our bread and butter at 10 o'clock, the classrooms with the desks and the forms, the corridor with the rows of hat pegs, they are all just the same. And yet to us it seems somehow as if they belonged to another world. Only the smell of the gloomy rooms is familiar. Not so rank, but still similar to that of the barracks. The great organ with its hundreds of pipes is gleaming in the hall. To the right stand the masters in a group. On the principal's desk are two potted plants with coarse, leathery leaves. In front of it hangs a laurel wreath tied with a big ribbon. The principal is in his frock coat. So, there's to be a welcome. We pile up together in a heap. Nobody wants to be in the front rows. Only Vili takes up his place there, unembarrassed. In the semi-darkness of the hall, his head is glowing like the red lamp outside a brothel. I look at the group of masters. For us they were once more than other men, not merely because they were in charge of us, but because, however much we may have made fun of them, we believed in them. Today we see them merely as so many somewhat older men of whom we feel mildly contemptuous. There they stand now and propose to teach us again. But we expect them to set aside some of their dignity. For, after all, what can they teach us? We know life now better than they. We have gained another knowledge. Harsh, bloody, cruel, inexorable. We could teach them for that matter, but who would be bothered? If a sudden raid were to be made on the hall just now, they would all be rushing about like a bunch of poodles, frightened out of their wits, without a ghost of an idea what to do, whereas not a man of us would lose his head. As the first thing to be done, merely that they should not be in the way, we should quietly lock them all up and then begin the defense. The principal is clearing his throat for a speech. The words spring round and smooth from his mouth. He is an excellent talker, one must admit that. He speaks of the heroic struggle of the troops, of battles, of victories, and of courage. But for all the fine words, I feel there is a snag in it somewhere. Perhaps just because of the fine words. It was not so smooth and round as all that. I look at Ludwig. He looks at me. Albert, Waldorf, Westerholt. It does not suit any of them. The principal is getting into his stride. He celebrates not only the heroism out there, but now the quieter heroism at home also.
We at home here have done our duty, too. We have pinched and gone hungry for our soldiers. We have agonized. We have trembled. It was hard. Sometimes, perhaps, it has been almost harder for us than for our brave lads in field gray out yonder.
Hopla, says Vesterholt. Murmurs begin to be heard. The old man casts a sidelong glance in our direction and goes on.
But indeed, such things are not to be weighed and nicely balanced. You have looked into the brazen face of death without fear. You have discharged your great task. And though final victory has not accompanied our arms, yet all the more will we now stand together, united in passionate love of our afflicted fatherland. In defiance of all hostile powers, we will rebuild it. Rebuild it in the spirit of our ancient teacher Goethe, whose voice now rings out so commandingly across the centuries to our own troubled time. Let might assail. We live and will prevail.
The old man's voice sinks to a minor. It puts on mourning. It drips unction. A sudden tremor passes over the black flock of masters. Their faces show self-control, solemnity.
But especially, we would remember those fallen sons of our foundation, who hastened joyfully to the defense of their homeland, and who have remained upon the field of honor. 21 comrades are with us no more. 21 warriors have met the glorious death of arms. 21 heroes have found rest from the clamor of battle under foreign soil, and sleep the long sleep beneath the green grasses.
There is a sudden booming laughter. The principal stops short in pained perplexity. The laughter comes from Vili, standing there, big and gaunt, like an immense wardrobe. His face is red as a turkey's, he is so furious.
Green grasses! Green grasses! He stutters.
Long sleep? In the mud of shell holes they are lying, knocked rotten, ripped in pieces, gone down into the bog. Green grasses! This is not a singing lesson.
His arms are whirling like a windmill in a gale.
Hero's death! And what sort of a thing do you suppose that was, I wonder? Would you like to know how young Hoyer died? All day long, he lay out in the wire screaming, and his guts hanging out of his belly like macaroni. Then a bit of shell took off his fingers, and a couple of hours later, another chunk off his leg. And still he lived. And with his other hand, he would keep trying to pack back his intestines. And when night fell at last, he was done. And when it was dark, we went out to get him, and he was full of holes as a nutmeg grater. Now you go and tell his mother how he died, if you have so much courage.
The principal is pale. He is hesitating whether to enforce discipline or to humor us, but he arrives at neither the one nor the other.
Mr. Principal, begins Albert Troska, we have not come here that you should tell us we did our job well, though unfortunately, as you say, we were not victorious. Hell to that!
The principal winces, and with him the whole College of Masters.
I must request you, at least in your expressions, he begins indignantly. Hell, I say. Hell, and again hell, reiterates Albert. That has been our every third word for years, and it's high time that you knew it. But you don't seem to realize how things stand. We are none of your brave scholars. We are none of your good schoolboys. We are soldiers.
But, gentlemen,
cries the old man, almost imploringly.
There is a misunderstanding, a most painful misunderstanding.
But he does not finish. He is interrupted by Helmut Reinersmann, who carried his brother back through a bombardment on the Isere, only to put him down dead at the dressing station.
Killed, he says savagely. They were not killed for you to make speeches about them. They were our comrades. Enough! Let's have no more wind-bagging about it.
The place is in wild confusion. The principal stands there horrified and utterly helpless. The College of Masters looks like a lot of scandalized old hens. Only two of the teachers are calm, and they were soldiers. The old man decides to humor us at all costs. We are too many, and Villy stands there too formidably trumpeting before him. And who can say what these undisciplined fellows may not be doing next? They may even produce bombs from their pockets. He beats the air with his arms as an archangel his wings, but no one listens to him. Then suddenly comes a lull in the tumult. Ludwig Breyer has stepped out to the front. There is silence.
Mr. Principal, says Ludwig in a clear voice, you have seen the war after your fashion, with flying banners, martial music, and with glamour. But you saw it only to the railway station from which we set off. We do not mean to blame you. We too thought as you did. But we have seen the other side since then, and against that the heroics of 1914 soon wilted to nothing. Yet we went through with it. We went through with it because there was something deeper that held us together, something that only showed up out there, a responsibility, perhaps, but at any rate something of which you know nothing and about which there can be no speeches.
Ludwig pauses a moment, gazing vacantly ahead. He passes his hand over his forehead and continues.
We have not come to ask a reckoning. That would be foolish. Nobody knew then what was coming. But we do require that you shall not again try to prescribe what we shall think of these things. We went out full of enthusiasm, the name of the fatherland on our lips, and we have returned in silence, but with the thing, the fatherland, in our hearts. And now we ask you to be silent too. Have done with fine phrases. They are not fitting, nor are they fitting to our dead comrades. We saw them die, and the memory of it is still too near for us to abide, to hear them talked of as you are talking. They died for more than that.
Now everywhere it is quiet. The principal has his hands clasped together.
But, Breyer, he says gently, I did not mean it, so...
Ludwig has done. After a while, the principal continues.
But tell me, then, what is it that you do want?
We look at one another. What do we want? Yes, if it were so easy a thing to say in a sentence. A vague, urgent sense of it we have. But for words, we have no words for it yet. But perhaps later we shall have. After a moment's silence, Westerholt pushes his way to the front and plants himself in front of the principal.
Let's hear something practical, says he. That's what we're here for now. Here we are, 70 soldiers, and we have to go back to school again. What do you propose to do with us? And I may as well tell you at once we know as good as nothing now of all your bookish stuff. And what's more, we've no wish to stay here longer than need be.
The principal checks his displeasure. He explains that as yet he has had no instructions in the matter from the authorities. For the present, we must go back to the several classes from which we went out. Then, later, of course, we shall see what arrangements can be made. This is answered with mutterings and laughter.
Don't you run away with the idea, says Villy indignantly, that we're going to perch on forms along with kids who never saw the war and put up our hands nicely whenever we know anything. We're staying together.
We are beginning to see now how funny it all is. For years we have been allowed to shoot and stab and kill. And now it is a matter of grave importance whether it was from the second form or from the third form that we went off to do it. In this one they do equations with two unknowns, and in the other with only one. These are the differences that matter here. The principal promises to ask that a special course be granted for soldiers.
We can't wait for that, says Albert Troske curtly. We had better see about it ourselves.
The principal does not reply. He walks to the door in silence. The masters follow, and we traipse out after them. But Villy, for whom it has all gone much too smoothly, first takes the two potted plants from the lecture desk and smashes them onto the floor.
I never could stomach vegetables anyway, he says viciously.
The laurel wreath he plants askew on Vesterholt's head.
Make yourself soup out of it.
We are sitting in council with the returned men from the grammar school. Vesterholt has brought a copy of the old school regulations and is reading aloud from it. Progress is slow, for almost every paragraph is received with roars of laughter. We can hardly believe that such rules once applied to us. Vesterholt is particularly amused to discover that before the war, we were not allowed to be on the streets after 9 o'clock at night without permission of a form master. But Villy deals with him.
Don't you be too fresh, Alvin, he shouts across at him. You've flouted your form master worse than any of us. What with saying you were killed and getting yourself a funeral oration off the principal, and him saying you were a hero and a model scholar. And then after that you have the damned cheek to come back alive. Nice predicament you've landed the old man in. Now he'll have to take back all the credit he gave to your corpse. For if I know anything, you're just as rotten at algebra and composition as ever you were.
We elect a students' council, for though our schoolmasters may do, perhaps, to pump a few facts into us for examination purposes, we are certainly not going to let them govern us any more. For ourselves, we appoint as representatives Ludwig Breyer, Helmut Reinersmann, and Albert Troske. For the grammar school, Georg Rahe and Karl Brugger. Then we settle on 3 delegates to start next morning for the provincial authorities and the ministry to set out our demands regarding the syllabus and the examination. For this purpose, we choose Villy, Vesterholt, and Albert. Ludwig cannot go, as he is still not well enough. The 3 are then duly equipped with passes and free railway vouchers, of which we have whole blocks in hand. And we have, of course, plenty of lieutenants and soldiers' counselors to countersign them. Helmut Reinersmann looks to it that the delegation shall have the appropriate outward appearance also. He requires Villy to leave at home the new outfit that he pinched from the quartermaster, and to put on for the journey a soiled and tattered one instead.
But why? Asks Villy, disappointed.
That will tell with the pen pushers more than 100 good reasons, explains Helmut. Villy protests, for he is very proud of his tunic and thought to make rather a hit with it in the cafes of the capital.
If I thump good and hard on the inspector's table, won't that do just as well? He suggests.
But Helmut is not to be dissuaded.
It's no good, Villy, says he. We can't knock them all on the head. We have need of these people for once. But if you thump on the table in a ragged tunic, then I say you'll get more out of them for us than in your new one. That is the sense of the meeting, I take it.
Villy gives way, and Helmut now turns his attention to Alvin Westerholt. He seems to him to appear too naked, so Ludwig Breyer's decoration is pinned on his chest. "Your arguments will sound much more convincing to an undersecretary that way," adds Helmut. In Albert's case, this is not necessary. He has enough medals to show on his own account. At length, the three are satisfactorily furnished, and Helmut surveys his handiwork.
"Superb," says he.
"Now for it, and show the bloody turnip eaters for once what a real frontline man-eater looks like."
"Make your mind easy on that score," says Willy,
now quite himself again. The smoke of pipes and cigars fills the room. Desires, thoughts, ambitions in seething confusion. God only knows what will come of them. 100 young soldiers, 18 lieutenants, 30 warrant officers and non-coms, all sitting here, wanting to start to live. Any man of them could take a company under fire across no man's land with hardly a casualty. There is not one who would hesitate for an instant to do the right thing when the cry, "They are coming!" was yelled down into his dugout. Every man has been tempered through countless, pitiless days. Every man is a complete soldier, no more and no less. But for peace, are we suitable? Are we fit now for anything but soldiering?